You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Milwaukee pinball expert set a new Guinness record on one of his favorite machines, but the record wasn't his only goal.
Now, you may well remember Professor Mike Leckrone as the longtime director of the UW Marching Band. He retired from that position recently after 50 years at the helm, but he's still sharing his love of music.
We talked with him when he taught a course this fall about the big band era through the UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies, and he's gearing up to teach Part 2 in February. You can find information on how to register at continuingstudies.wisc.edu.
Mike Leckrone joined us in the studio. Mike, great to have you here.
Oh, Rob, I'm pleased to be here. Really am.
Well, take us to the big band era. What is the time period we're really talking about with the heyday of the big bands?
Well, the real heyday occurred in the 30s. Remember, everybody thinks of the 30s as the big band era, but because that's in 1935. That's when Benny Goodman got started and the Carnegie Hall concert came shortly later. But it really started really before that. I mean, you go back to the time of Duke Ellington, Paul Whiteman. That was in the 20s, and that's where bands started being almost you'd say a headliner in theaters, on stage, everywhere they could go. So it goes back really into the beginning of the 30s, and it lasted till about 1945. And then after the war, singers started to take over all of the pop music charts at that time.
And it seems our two jobs kind of lined up there. The real heyday, the rise of the big bands, came along with the rise of radio. How important was them coming in at the same time?
Well, radio was very important because in the earliest days, a performer had to appear on the radio to get any notice at all, because there wasn't the recording industry that we have now. And then when recordings came in after radio, then radio became even more important so far as the bands were concerned, because that's where all the discs, that's where all the recordings got out. The disc jockeys started to take over and do a lot. So the radio and the era of the big bands really coincided almost exactly at the same time.
Before we start listening to some music, I want to talk about the range of music, because it seems like you've got stuff that was almost like the punk rock, like a lot of improvisation to really heavily orchestrated stuff, swingy dance tunes to slow dance tunes. We're talking about a lot of different types of music, right?
Right. When people ask me what was a big band, I usually use three or four criteria. First of all, they had to have more than seven people.
had to be big.
Yeah, it had to be big. And some people say, well, seven isn't very big, but you have to have enough people that you can have sections. You can't just have solo instruments playing, because then it's kind of like a jazz combo at that point. But if you've got more than seven people, you almost by necessity have to have sections. And then they have to play written arrangements or things that are heavily arranged so that it sounds the same every time. A lot of people use what they call head arrangements at that time. And then the third element is dancing. You've got to be able to dance to this early music, and that's where it really got most of its impetus at that point.
We are talking about the music of the big band era. Mike Leckrone is with us, longtime band director at UW-Madison. He's teaching a course on the topic now. Well, let's hear some music, and I want to start with a name you mentioned, Duke Ellington and his orchestra. Don't Mean a Thing.
Don't mean a thing if you ain't got that swing.
It don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is swing.
I think you've got a whole section of the class just on Duke Ellington. You could probably do a whole class Ellington.
You could do a year on Duke Ellington, yeah, because he was such an important figure in American music. I think some people say Duke Ellington was American music at one point. That's a quote that is often used. But he started so many things, and he started in an era where it was just coming. Jazz was just coming out of the districts where people didn't really like to consider it nice music. It was music that was, you know, played in all sorts of areas, the bars and so forth, and said it had a bad reputation. But Ellington started to make a little bit more of a concert appearance. It became not just music for the bars, not just music for dances and so forth. It became highly personalized music. And I think when you listen to Ellington, everything that he did had that flavor of Duke Ellington. You couldn't miss his band for anybody.
And I want to give a listen to Paul Whiteman, a song called Happy Feet, before we talk about Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. I think you've got another section in your class
on him too,
this is a whirlwind tour here. We only have a little bit of time. Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. understand there was some controversy over Paul Whiteman declaring himself the king of jazz.
Well, yeah, and Whiteman was also always very clear to point out he didn't give himself that connotation.
Okay. That was given to him.
It was given to him by some of his fans and some of his promoters, but he accepted it. I think he didn't turn his back on it. But he was, the king of jazz. A lot of people said, well, what he play isn't jazz. But there again, we get into whether that's a definition that you want to follow or I want to follow, because jazz has just so many different areas. And this is music was highly arranged, very carefully arranged. And so there wasn't a lot of room for the soloist to get up. And I think there's a feeling for a lot of people when you hear jazz, you're hearing improvised solos. But with Whiteman, you didn't get too much of the improvisation. I think an argument for the Whiteman band as being a jazz band is the guys who wrote the arrangements were highly trained jazz musicians, and so they wrote things in that flavor of the time. So it was music that was one time removed from actually being performed extemporaneously.
Well, this is the kind of argument you could have with any type of music. It's like, is it jazz for decades? No. Is this really rock? Is this really classical music? A lot of the arguments we have over any kind of music, they happen with the big band era too.
Well, yeah, and the big band era, one of the things that I find very interesting about it, it's the only time, I think, in American popular music that jazz was the popular idiom. When you get to a little later periods, jazz loses some of its popularity to rock and roll. And in fact, there was a short period of time where it was country western would probably be considered the American music. But with jazz, it had that short period of time from, say, 35 to 45, where it was what everybody thought of as American popular music.
Oh, and it made it into the movies, too. We've got a clip of Cab Calloway here in the movie Stormy Weather, 1943, I think. Here's a listen. So this is the pinnacle of not just music culture, but pop culture in a lot of ways, too.
Right. And you know, Cab Calloway sometimes overlooked because he was such a pop figure. I mean, he was this jive guy that got on the radio and talked jive talk, and he was really a character. And so a lot of what he did musically was lost because he was considered more of this almost a caricature of what a jazz musician should have been at the time. But he was really quite good, and if you listen to some of his vocals, they have the same kind of spontaneous contemporary jazz that you would expect at the time.
That's interesting. I've heard the same argument made over a Louis Armstrong. He was such a character, and people focused on the character. Yeah. And I think it was when the commemorative stamp came out, music people were really glad they showed him actually playing the trumpet.
Right.
They showed him as a musician, not just as a celebrity.
Right. He had become a pop figure because of sometimes it's just his singing, because he was singing pop songs that had made it to the hit parade. I mean, he had a big tune on Hello Dolly back in the 60s, and people looked at him as that kind of a figure as opposed to what he was, which is a giant in the area of jazz.
I want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm calling to tell you that my father arranged music for Paul Whiteman. My father was sent to a seminary in Cincinnati when he was 9 years old. His mother proclaimed that he should be a priest. So he stayed at the seminary for many, many years, but never took any vows, got out, started a band because he had received a wonderful music education at this seminary, started a band, and eventually got in contact with Paul Whiteman and started arranging his music. My father's name was Leon Matthew, and I'm sure that your guest probably has seen his name on old sheet music.
I have seen the name, yeah.
Nancy, yeah, thank you so much. Wow, what a story. I guess he did find his calling after all. Can you talk about, that reminds me, the role of the composer and arranger, because Duke Ellington had, Billy Strayhorn writing music with him?
Billy Strayhorn wrote a lot of things. He was sort of what we might more... scholastically call an amanuensis, because he would sometimes Ellington would even call him on the phone and say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and uh-huh. Strayhorn would write it down. Duke had his own talent, and he was very careful to most of the time, and I'll put that most of the time, credit all those people. I mean, if you see a tune that Billy Strayhorn Take the A Train, right. for example, that's credited solely to Billy Strayhorn, who probably Ellington did some of the work on it, but I think it was at a time when Ellington was feeling very, very generous and felt like, well, some of these royalties should go to Strayhorn, who was so helpful in what he did.
Professor Mike Leckrone is with us to talk about a continuing education class that he's teaching about the big band era. You might know him as the former director of the UW Bands and the UW-Madison Marching Band.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a fan of the big band era? Who were your favorite performers or favorite songs? Did you ever get to see or meet any of your idols from that era? And do you enjoy modern musicians who are keeping that style alive? Tweet your stories to us at Central Time WPR.
We'll be back with Mike Leckrone shortly. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're continuing a conversation about the big band era with Professor Mike Leckrone. The former UW Marching Band Director is teaching classes through the UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies. You can find information on how to register for the next session at continuingstudies.wisc.edu.
And we want to hear from you. Do you listen to big band music? Did your parents or grandparents play it when you were growing up? Give a shout out to your favorite songs or performers by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. Mike, we came in with Woody Herman there, a big Wisconsin connection
Wisconsin,
on that one.
Wisconsin kid, born in Milwaukee, and did most of his formative years in that Milwaukee area playing, and he was billed often as the boy wonder of the clarinet, but he also tap danced, he sang, and this was as a kid when he was in junior high school and high school, and so he has great Wisconsin connection, and then became one of the biggest names in the big band era.
Was Wisconsin a hot place for big bands, or were we just kind of a stopover?
No, I think Milwaukee, if you look at the history of Milwaukee, you'll see that a lot of the big bands made their home there. Plus, this was a great place. You say it a stopping place, but it was also a very important opportunity for people to play if they were going to Chicago or coming out of Chicago. So by its very nature, Wisconsin has a huge history in the development of big bands, and their former dance halls all over the state that can claim that so-and-so performed here in Madison in McFarland, the Park Ponderosa for many years was up into the 80s and 90s. It was a pretty hotbed for bands that were touring still and playing.
I wanted to bring up a race. This is a segregated era through most of the United States. Some bands were segregated. Occasionally, some weren't. Can you talk about how that all went?
Well, most of the bands at this point were segregated. When they did break the color line, as they used to say it, it was often big news. The one who probably did it the most dramatically was Benny Goodman when he broke the color line with his Teddy Wilson and some of the other people that Lionel Hampton, and that broke that immediately. You saw white musicians and black musicians playing together on stage, and that was a very, very important step. The interesting thing is it didn't cause much consternation. The audiences at that point were so engrossed with the big band period that they just accepted the fact that these musicians were going to learn to play together, and it came off without too much of a difficulty. There were other instances. You mentioned Count Basie, and Count Basie at different times would hire singers that didn't look black enough, as they would say. They would have to make them up so that they would look more fitting into the part. And even Duke Ellington, there was a man named Juan Tizel who was Cuban, and they had to make Juan Tizel up to look darker when he would appear on stage. So that was the kind of times that we were going through. Gradually, that the musicians felt that they broke down a lot of those color lines, so that they disappeared. And you mentioned earlier Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong toured for many years with Jack Teagarden, who was a white musician, and they played on stage many, many times, and without any concern at all about it.
Let's go back to our callers now. Larry is with us in New Berlin. Larry, hi.
Hi. Great talk. You asked if people, if they liked the big band era, or if they I always had trouble with it. It always seemed like a smoothing over of jazz. But the thing that really irritated me was the sense of the big band director, that one of the things about jazz was always this really free individuality, and you couldn't tell what was going to happen at any moment. And that gave way, kind of like in this, at the turn of the 1800s, the big orchestras came about and killed the groups of soloists.
Interesting, Larry. Thanks a lot for the call. So Larry's worried that you lost some of the individuality and some of the spontaneity when you took that small jazz act and turned it into a 17-piece band or whatever.
Well, I think that's a good argument, but I think the argument that would be in favor of the big bands would say that what you did is you substituted the arrangers who put that spontaneity, who put that improvisation, you'd say, into the music. They would write it out so that you were hearing a sense of improvisation. I heard many jazz performers play things that I didn't think were terribly improvised, that you knew they had picked up it by playing the solo over and over. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened with the big bands. They wrote out a lot of this improvisation. If you listen to a lot of Duke Ellington, you'll notice he might play a tune like Black and Tan Fantasy. He might have recorded it. Well, I think he recorded it probably 12 or 15 times. But it's different many of the times, and that shows you the creativity that they brought to that thing. And some of the bands got stuck in a rut and played the same arrangements the same way every time, but the big bands opened up, as the terminology would have been it today, and they would say, okay, Harry James, you play a solo in this 32 bars, or Benny Goodman, you play your solo, and it would be totally improvised for that period of time.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to David in Elkhorn. David, hi.
Hi. I saw Duke Ellington at the Summerfest in the very early years of Miller Jazz Oasis. My girlfriend and I got somehow ended up sitting on stage with a back against the PA system right about 8 feet from Duke Ellington. And nobody could see us from the audience. And Duke Ellington would play, and he'd be winking at her. And each time a soloist came out and got to the front to do a solo, they'd walk down across the stage, and they'd play right directly to her, looking her right in the eye. And nobody could see that from the audience. And
that's the story. David, you got to share a stage with Duke Ellington. Not many musicians can say that. You had a story about Duke Ellington spending a week on the campus at UW-Madison.
This is about 1970, the university saw fit to bring Duke Ellington and his entire band to the campus for a week. And they played in every facility on campus that they could have. They played at the Union. They played at the stadium. They played in the field house. They played everywhere you could imagine. And it was just a wonderful experience. Plus, Duke and his band did daily clinics in the humanities building. And so that you got a chance to be right next to Duke Ellington as he was talking about the music. It was just a phenomenal experience, and it was there for a week. And as I think any of us that were there will never forget it.
Thanks a lot for calling and sharing that story. Back to your calls as we talk to Mike Lecrone about the big band era. He's teaching a class on it. Roger joins us from Milwaukee. Roger, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question, or two of my questions are, is how did some of these band members and band leaders get their nicknames, like Cozy Cole, Duke Ellington, Woody Herman, Count Basie, and are there any famous Wisconsin people besides Woody Herman who have nicknames for band leaders?
Roger, thanks. So first of all, we got a lot of nobility, the Counts and the Dukes out there.
Well, most people say that Duke Ellington started it, and he got that title mostly because he was such a dignified individual, and his real name is Edward Ellington, but Edward Kennedy Ellington, and people felt like this was a guy when he was on stage or when he was performing piano many times. He was a very elegant person, and so people started calling him Duke, and then it sort of crept out into other areas. Count Basie said that there's a Duke, and then there was a there ought to be a Count, and so it spread to a lot. The title thing got spread out to a lot of different people, and you know, Woody Herman, his obviously, his real name is Woodrow, so that was an easy one for them. And there were a lot of he mentioned Cozy Cole. Now, I don't know where that name came from, but my guess is that there's a lot of the names were playoffs on the person's original name. And I don't remember even what Cozy Cole's original name was, but it could have been something like Cosmo or something. Don't quote me on that one. But that's the way the names usually got. I mean, or sometimes they were Pee Wee Hunt was a famous band leader. Pee Wee Hunt was not very small. So it was kind of sometimes a lot of the band leaders got the name based on what they weren't as opposed to what they were.
And he had asked, any other names you want to drop apart from Woodrow Herman here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, it's been mentioned a couple of times, but there was a great trumpet player named Bunny Berrigan.
Sure.
Who was out of Fox Lake, Wisconsin. Bunny, again, his real name was Bernard, so it's kind of an easy transition to Bunny, but he was one of the great trumpet players of the era, and he was from Fox Lake and spent a lot of early years right here in Madison, playing at various venues around town.
Let's give a quick listen. Count Basie, you just mentioned, and Billie Holiday here, Swing Brothers Swing.
Deep rhythm captivates me. Hot rhythm stimulates me.
So talk about the role of the singers here, just our last few moments.
Well, the singers were sort of latecomers in a way. They were almost incidental to the big bands. In the earliest days, Paul Whiteman had singers, one of whom was Bing Crosby, who later on...
He did okay.
Yeah, he took off on his own, but most of the time it was the singers came in, they did their chorus or a half chorus, and then they sat down, and that was the end of it. But then they started developing a personality. A lot of that happened during the Second World War when... The manpower was hard to get, but some of the singers, Frank Sinatra, many people feel owe his fame to the fact that he was 4F, not eligible for the service, and so he got great popularity during that time during the war when a lot of the other people were being drafted and not being able to perform.
Well, Mike, we're out of time. Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
It went fast.
That was Professor Mike Leckrone. The former UW marching band director is teaching a class on the big band era through the UW-Madison Division of Continuing Studies. You can find info on how to register for the upcoming session at continuingstudies.wisc.edu.
We're going to go out listening to a huge hit from the big band era, Sing, 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 with Gene Krupa on drums, Harry James on trumpet, and Benny Goodman on clarinet. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to a Milwaukee man who spent more than 30 hours straight playing pinball, all for a good cause.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how watching your parents dance as a child shapes the legacy you leave behind with your own children.
Have you ever been at a wedding and caught a glimpse of your parents slow dancing? Maybe you marveled, or maybe you cringed, but I'm willing to bet you felt something. Jan Larson shares a story about how watching her parents dance in the kitchen brought her comfort as a child, and now as a mother as she watches her children forge their own affections.
The legacy parents leave their children isn't always easy to spot. On those rare occasions when we get a glimpse of something good, it is oh so sweet. As a child, I delighted in my father's nightly ritual. He would sneak up on my mother as they cleared away the dinner table or wiped down the countertops, and what was our kitchen transformed into their private ballroom dance floor. I only have eyes
for you.
He crooned tenderly as he wrapped his arms around her, his face nestled into that space along the back of her neck and shoulder. Gently, he twirled her around, ignoring her mock protests, and swept her into his arms in a glide across the linoleum floor. The moment was brief, enchanting, and one that left a young child certain of her parents' love. All was right with the world. Some years later, I met and married my own darling. And then, One night, while tidying the kitchen, I felt his arms wrap around me, hands turning me to face him as he guided me in our own dance across the hardwood floor. Happy tears pricked at my eyes as he twirled me, pulled me close, and then finished with the big dip. As toddlers, our children squealed with pleasure at Daddy's strength and the light in Mom's eyes. As teens, they offered eye rolls, shoulder shrugs, and the predictable, "Get a room," to which we replied, "We have a license, marriage, that is, to do this." But underneath the playful teasing, our children, too, were certain of their parents' love. And again, all was right with the world. Not too long ago, our eldest son stopped in for a Saturday brunch. As logs crackled in the fireplace and music filled our home, I busied myself in the kitchen. The little boy who once reached up to me, now a young man, put his hands on my shoulders and turned me to face him, pulling me toward him for his own dance. As we swayed to the music, he looked down. "I want to be like you," he said. Stunned, my response was brutally honest. "Why?" He tossed his head back in a brief laugh. "I just do." All my mistakes, all my flaws flashed through my mind. This would not do. I did not want to waste the moment. But what to say? "Take the good but leave the rest," I fairly pleaded. Another light laugh. "Okay, Mom." I realize now I don't need to fear for my son. He knows my flaws, yet finds reason to love. Perhaps in following his father's example, taking our dance and making it his own, he already has claimed the best we have to offer. If the legacy of children being certain of love is what we leave behind, then sweet is the knowledge that all will be right with the world.
Jan Larson is a journalist and professor at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now, a classic game of pinball. The flippers, the bells, the skyrocketing point totals can be fun for a few rounds, but more than 30 hours of it?
That's exactly what Ryan Clancy of Milwaukee accomplished recently and got some serious bragging rights as a result. But Ryan actually had a bigger goal in mind. Ryan joined us from Milwaukee to talk about it. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Set the stage for us. Tell us about this record you set, an actual Guinness record for playing pinball.
I did, yeah. It was actually 32 hours and 2 minutes.
Wow.
But didn't feel like a minute beyond 32 hours and 1 minute. So it just flew by.
And this is a record. I understand you were in contact with the previous record holder as you did this.
I was. It was amazing to see. I mean, the community support from not only the previous record holder, the person who did the call outs, like the voiceovers, Ed Robertson from Bare Naked Ladies, on the pinball machine itself. He got on the Twitch stream. We had teams of people working in 3s, 4s, and 5s. For 32 hours straight. It was just a really overwhelming to see the community support on this.
Now, we'll get into the details and the logistics here in a bit, but there was a bigger cause. What were you playing for here?
Absolutely. So through extralife.org, which is an organization that exists solely to give money to Children's Wisconsin, formerly Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, and they have one really big kind of fundraising campaign every year on the same weekend and kind of surrounding weekends as well, where they encourage people to donate. 100% of the funds raised from this and from other endeavors go right to children's hospitals all across the U.S.
And you had a personal connection with the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin.
I did, yeah. Just a few years ago, our son Alex got E. coli, his kidneys shut down, and Children's of Wisconsin saved his life. So we were just, overwhelmed and kind of blown away by the incredible care that he got at Children's Wisconsin. I think it's a terrible, traumatic experience for both the patient, for Alex, And for families, when people have to go through this, but we really just want kids all across Wisconsin to have the phenomenal care that he got at Children's.
Talking to Ryan Clancy of Milwaukee about his Guinness record playing pinball, as you just heard, raising money for the Children's Hospital there. All right, Ryan, what table were you playing here? What pinball machine?
It was called Black Knight Sword of Rage.
I've seen that in the bars. Yeah,
absolutely. It was, made right in the Midwest, just down in Chicago. And then apparently they did a pretty good job with it because that table held up surprisingly well for that much play.
And according to the conditions, you have to play the same game the whole time, but you got a backup, right?
I did, yeah. The very kind people at the Garcade in Menominee Falls loaned us a backup one, which we didn't have to use, but it sat there so in case ours started throwing out smoke or sparks or anything, we had an extra one there.
Now, people might be wondering, wait a minute, 32 hours, aren't there certain, physical necessities one has to attend to?
So, we had a lot of volunteers helping with that, too. My representative, Jonathan Prostoff, came a couple days before. He helped me time how long it would take to run down to the bathroom and run back. We got
Guinness
that down to
this.
About – absolutely. So I was able to bank about 5 minutes every hour to use for things like that. And, man, it was it took a whole team to get this going.
Now, you did this – was this at a coffee shop, did I see?
It was at Bounce Milwaukee in Bayview, which my wife and I own.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And – speaking of coffee, were you I assume I would be caffeinated if I tried to do something like this, which I wouldn't. Were you heavily caffeinated to stay alert 32 hours?
I thought that I would be. We actually got a great coffee donation from Anodyne here in Milwaukee, but I didn't need it. I got through 32 hours and probably could have gone a little bit longer. But my 5-year-old Fiona was, yanking at my pants leg to get me to come home. So I was able to do it without caffeine, but really appreciate that donation and really all the volunteers that stepped up to help.
Now, you play a lot of pinball. Was this some of your best quality gaming or was this all about the quantity?
Boy, I have more enthusiasm for pinball than I do talent. So I appreciate you leading in by saying that I was a pinball expert, but that might not be totally true. There are many better players out
pinball
there.
Pinball aficionado.
Aficionado is perfect, yeah, at least prior to my attempt. I still do appreciate pinball, although I have taken a break from that one specific game for at least a few days here.
I've had experience in my life where I play, say, a computer game, like Civilization, and if I play it too long, I lay down and close my eyes to go to bed for the night, and I just see the screen in front of me. Was it like that for you? Were you, like, visualizing pinball every moment you closed your eyes?
I thought that I would be, and I didn't. So I slept for about 14 hours straight. I don't remember anything about that. But thankfully I didn't have the call-outs or anything still stuck in my head. But I peaked in terms of skill about 7 or 8 hours in, and then it was just a slow, steady decline into, going through the motions towards the end. It really was a great experience, and it was all the volunteers that kind of kept me going. I kept thanking them, for showing up at three in the morning. I looked around, and there were six people up there.
Nice.
Not just standing there looking bored, but really, really into the idea of supporting this great cause.
You've got this Guinness record now for the most time consecutively spent playing pinball. Do you expect it to be broken anytime soon?
I hope that it is. I mean, for bragging purposes, I suppose when I go out to bars, it's nice to introduce myself as a Guinness record holder. But really the point of this was to raise money through Extra Life. I would love it. Let me have it for a couple of weeks or months. But if somebody wants to come along and break that record, please just do, raise some good funds for it. The previous holder, Wayne Johns, was a great guy. He had raised money for prostate cancer research. I hope that somebody takes it but does it with good intent.
You worry about carpal tunnel. How are you feeling after 32 hours at the pinball machine?
I was hurting about 8 hours in.
Really?
And we had a retired occupational therapist. Her name is Barb Coyle, and I am so indebted to her because I was putting all my weight on my wrists, and she came up and yelled at me and straightened out my wrists and, fed me ibuprofen. Pretty much poured it down my throat, and I'm really indebted to her and all the volunteers.
If you were to try something like this again, what machine would you reach for?
Oh boy, I don't know. I guess the next greatest one that comes out. So I really like the Deadpool pinball machine too. It's a ton of fun.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us. Congratulations on the fundraiser and your record.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Ryan Clancy, co-owner of Bounce Milwaukee. We talked to him today about setting a new Guinness World Record for playing pinball while raising money to support Children's Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll look into the ways that Teddy Roosevelt helped create America's sports culture during his time in the White House.
Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. A lot of U.S. presidents have spent some time before and during their terms in office playing sports, everything from tennis and football to wrestling and fencing.
One president, Teddy Roosevelt, did all of those and a lot more. He advocated for a life filled with physical exercise, and our next guest says that Americans at the time followed his lead.
Roosevelt's time in office saw a boom in the popularity of organized sports, leaving us with a lot of the athletic culture we still have today.
Ryan Swanson is an associate professor of history at the University of New Mexico. He's author of the book, The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, give us the origin story. Where did Teddy Roosevelt's passion, maybe obsession with physical activity get started?
You got to start with his childhood, actually. So Theodore Roosevelt has terrible asthma as a kid. And this is beyond, you know, tightness of breath or thinking today like needing an inhaler or something like that. From age three until his early teen years, he can't breathe. He has kind of these crises on a daily basis, so much so that he can't go to school and he can't compete athletically. And so initially, you know, his early part of his life, he can't do this strenuous life that he'll promote so vigorously in his adulthood. But when he hits his teen years, his father actually sits him down for a father-son chat. And to paraphrase, he basically says, you know, I'm proud of you. You're well-read, you're well-spoken, you're a smart young man, but if you don't make your body, you're not going to succeed in life. And so he challenges him, basically, deal with your asthma. The family had tried everything, you know, all the remedies of the day. Now, I'm a father. That doesn't strike me as particularly fair to tell your kid to solve their own asthma, but that's what he did. And Roosevelt remembers it as a turning point in his life. He tells his father, basically, I accept the challenge. And from that point forward, he gets heavily involved in physical training, wrestling, boxing. He starts going to a gym on a regular basis, and something rather miraculous happens. This terrible asthma actually goes away, at least for the most part. Now, what we know today is it's pretty common for kids to age out of the worst of asthma in their teen years. But for Roosevelt, he'll always keep this connection, the idea that I was involved in athletics, I worked out, I, you know, strained my body, and I got better and I got stronger. So he'll keep that connection in his mind, both for himself and more broadly, throughout his life, and he takes that into the White House. So that's kind of, I think, the genesis of why he's so interested in sports.
Now, your book traces Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's personal arc, but it's happening with a lot of relevant stuff going on in American society. You write a concern that as we become a more urban culture, we're getting soft, weak, lazy, we lack exercise. Can you talk about how Teddy Roosevelt and others at the time tried to tackle that, what they saw as a problem?
Yeah, by the time Roosevelt takes the White House in 1901, the nation is several decades into urbanization and industrialization, and there's a real concern that this generation is weak. They're not fit to be American citizens. To be honest, it sounds somewhat like what you hear today. You know, our kids are playing too much Fortnite and they're, you know, staying in their room. So I think there's some real similar angst. But Roosevelt believes that, you know, I mean, on some level, he'd love it if the U.S. was in a war some of these times to kind of improve men. But if that's not available, you know, he believes that athletics can serve a role in this changing society. In a, you know, New York City, for example, where he's from, you know, there aren't very many open spaces. There's not a lot of room for activity. So you have to carve these spaces out. You have to create gymnasiums. So Roosevelt, along with other leaders like Luther Gulick, who is influential in the public schools athletic league in New York City, Dudley Sargent, who's really the forefather of physical education at Harvard, and others, you have these individuals and organizations pointing to athletics really as part of the progressive movement to fix what's wrong with society at the turn of the century.
Talking to Ryan Swanson, his new book is The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete. A lot of what you just said has stuck with us. Another thing that came out of Roosevelt's time in office was what we now know as the NCAA. What was happening in college athletics, in particular college football, that led us there?
When Roosevelt's in the White House, there's an abolition movement related to football. Basically, by the time you get to 1905 is when it in some ways peaks. You have around 19 deaths. Academics kind of argue over the exact number, but you got 19 football players dying on the football field in 1905. You have scores and scores of terrible injuries. So with that going on, there's a movement, which makes sense on a lot of levels to think about why we are playing football at educational institutions. And this abolition movement, ironically, is led by the president of Roosevelt's alma mater, Harvard. Charles Eliot does not want football at Harvard, despite the fact that Harvard's the football power of the time. So with these kind of pushes, this pushing back against football, you have reform movements on the other side, which are trying to kind of round off some of the rough edges so that the game can remain palatable, yet still violent, but still part of college campuses. So out of that, there's a lot of meetings. You know, this is an American story, so there has to be meetings. And there's some compromises. Eventually, you'll get the forward pass in a few years introduced. But out of those compromises and meetings, the NCAA is born, really with the desire to regulate college sports so that it develops character and it makes strenuous young men and women, but it doesn't kill people and it doesn't compromise the mission of universities. So that's the NCAA as it gets going in 1906.
One bleaker side of the story you point to is that in part Teddy Roosevelt and others were concerned about a vigorous, strenuous life for what they saw as the well-being of the white race in particular. Can you talk about the racial side of this story?
Yeah, Roosevelt is, I think, has something in common with the majority of white America at this time. He can connect in his own mind the idea of athletics and physical prowess to the preservation of his race. And Roosevelt is a man of his times to a certain extent. He sees the white race as superior. He certainly has an imperialist streak, as, you know, evidenced by his desires in the Philippines and elsewhere. So Roosevelt, you know, on a personal or on an individual level, he wants, you know, people to be treated with dignity and equality. But systematically, he sees the white race as needing to be preserved. And he connects that to athletics. You know, if white boys and girls are able to develop their physical skills, stronger lungs, stronger muscles, that's only going to help the white race continue to dominate, at least in Roosevelt's view. So yes, that is certainly a dark underbelly of this. And as we think about athletics and race today, I think it's worth noting that issue has been part of sports in America as far as back as we can look, basically.
What can we see in our youth sports landscape, our school gym landscape today that we can trace back to Teddy Roosevelt?
The connection of elementary and middle schools and high schools to sports goes directly back to Roosevelt's time. In 1903, the New York City Public Schools hires a guy named Luther Gulick, who is an absolute revolutionary. He's kind of a wild man. He has all kinds of ideas about making Americans healthier, but they hire him to be the director of physical education for the school district. And it's a really daunting task. Basically, they say, all right, we've got 600,000 kids. We've got, a budget of several hundred million dollars. We need you to make our kids healthier physically because we're noticing that they seem to be, despite all the advantages of technology that are coming, they seem to be weaker than we think they should be. So they set him loose on this task with really very few resources. And as part of that, he sets two things in motion, really. First of all, he creates physical fitness testing in the schools. If you're of a certain age, you probably remember the presidential fitness test, mm-hmm. Where you had to run a mile and you had to do the shuttle relay and you had to try to do a pull-up. You know, that was always hard for a lot of us. That's set up by the Public Schools Athletic League, led by Luther Gulick in 1903. He also, though, sets up the idea of interscholastic athletic competition. So school teams for elementary age kids, middle school kids, let's let them compete in sports. Let's have these big track meets, these big basketball tournaments as a way to promote physical competition. So, you know, if you think of the idea of student athlete, you know, from elementary all the way up through college, that really has roots in this period of 1903 or of Roosevelt's administration. So I think we're seeing the benefits and the problems of that legacy.
In our last few moments, you've got a lot of anecdotes about Teddy Roosevelt's obsession with athletics. One of the ones that struck me was that as president, he was disappointed. He had a hard time finding boxing partners who would actually strike him.
That's right. He invites several former champions into the White House, and he'll tell them at the beginning, you know, as they're putting on their gloves, I want your best shot. Now, you know, if I was a boxing champion, I certainly wouldn't do that, and they didn't either. But he'll get really frustrated with them, and he'll still give them a black eye, even though they won't hit him back because he's president. So, yeah, he's always frustrated with this.
But he does feel bad about that if he gives them a bloody nose or a black eye because he knows they were holding back.
He does. He does. He kind of can't help but compete, but he realizes that he has actually rather limited athletic skills, even though he competes and loves it so much.
Ryan, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ryan Swanson is an associate professor of history at the University of New Mexico. He talked with us about his book, The Strenuous Life, Theodore Roosevelt and the Making of the American Athlete.